The following is brought to you by TheKnowledge.com, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics podcast for July 28th, 2021. It's your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you from Austin, Texas. We actually got some news in today's episode. I know that is few and far between as we are on the dark side of the political calendar, but infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure. Will they? Won't they? Are they gonna do it? Can they get together? What is actually stopping this bipartisan deal from happening? And if and when it totally implodes, what's the next step? All of that discussed. Also, the January 6th commission has officially gaveled in. They had their first day of testimony. What is at stake? Whether or not the Republicans are going to pay for the fact that this is now a totally partisan-driven process, and some comparisons to other commissions, including Benghazi. I don't know whether or not that annoys people. I'm sure it annoys some people when I compare the January 6th commission to Benghazi, but I do think that it is important to look at them in context. And then if you don't think that that's real, then you can dismiss it. Also, this is a weird interview that we're going to do, because I had on somebody that I know is very funny. Brian Sack. Hilarious comedian, great writer. And when I asked him what he wanted to talk about, he mentioned that there was like a thing he had a personal window into. And it involves what I'm going to say is critical race theory, understanding that when I say that, depending on your political leanings, you understand it to mean different things. But the idea that our education needs to be revised so we can allow in some of the ideas that our culture has accepted over the last few years, specifically it could be derisively called the woke culture, right? But that is the topic. And specifically, you are going to hear Brian Sack not as a comedian. There are precious few jokes in this interview, but rather as a father who is in the middle of a school fighting with itself over how far and how necessary some of the diversity interventionism is. And I think this is an open conversation. You know, as you're going to hear, Brian's got his own POV on it. And it's a POV that I think is important to understand in the context of that's that dude's son in the middle of it. But it's an interesting conversation. And I'm glad to have it on here. It's raw. It's certainly not walking the analytical line. It's not walking the comedic line that we very often do. But if the ability of this, dark side of the moon in the political calendar gives us is that we can try to spread our wings a little bit and try different things, then this is going to be one of those different things. I hope you guys stay and listen to it. I found it to be a fascinating conversation. We'll get to that.
But first,
we were supposed to have bipartisan infrastructure on Monday. We didn't. And now the entire process looks a little bleak. Is the fact that we have 11th hour stalling, scraping, and screaming a sign that this will definitely get done, because the only time to fight the loudest is when you know that you will very quickly no longer be fighting? Or is that fat lady ready to do-re-mi? All right, before we get into it, a real quick preamble for those of you that are just catching up on this. Infrastructure has been a thing that every modern president has wanted to do because on its face, it's very popular. The problem is it's very popular. And so anything in Congress that is very popular means that other things are going to get stapled to it because it seems very likely that it's going to happen. So, it never happens. Everybody talks about it, nobody does it. Meanwhile, the one thing that even the most hardcore fiscal conservative and tax and spend liberal can agree on is that we should probably fix the roads, and we should fix the bridges, and the tunnels too. And, you know, even we're coming to an increasing understanding that broadband is also important, and much in the same way that we electrified areas of our country so we could bring elements of the Midwest and the South into modernity, we should probably do the same with broadband. So all that, let's just go ahead. Look, we are the richest country in the world. Let's peel off a few and let's make this thing right, huh? And if anybody could agree on anything, we probably would. But we can't, so we don't. And lo, we have our most modern attempt. And Biden was going to do it with a reconciliation package. And then he gives the nod for there to be a group of around 10 to 20, although the number fluctuates, bipartisan senators who say that they can put together a deal that if all the Democrats vote for it, it only takes 10 Republicans. There's 10 Republicans on the crew. They can agree to make this thing happen. Settle at a number around 1.4, 1.6 trillion. It's like 600 billion in brand new spending. Joe Biden thinks it's such a great idea that as soon as they come up with an agreement, Biden goes and has a press conference about how great it is. So then they have to go and write the sumbitch. And they try. And they try. And they try. And they get close. And then they try. And then they get close. And then they take one step back. And then they take two steps forward. And then, you know, we get to a point where Chuck Schumer's trying to goose it along last week. That doesn't work. But here we go. This is a via political. These are the last sticking points. And you can tell that there are 20 senators involved because these sticking points are kind of hilarious. Here we go. A Democratic source familiar with the bipartisan discussions said that the Democrats' counteroffer included accepting a GOP proposal for highways in exchange for a Democratic proposal on transit. But Republicans dispute that characterization. A GOP source familiar with the negotiations said that the choice isn't binary and that the GOP offer on transit was, quote, met with silence for 3 days. And people wonder why I like to focus on elections and not governing. We continue. Funding for water infrastructure remains unsolved, according to a Democratic source familiar with the talks, who accused Republicans of backing away from the original agreement. That source said that Mitt Romney had reneged on a deal and proposed something completely unworkable, end quote. A spokesperson for Romney called that, quote unquote, laughably false, and said that Schumer is seeking $15 billion more than the previous agreement. Meanwhile, Senate Environment and Public Works Chair Tom Carper from Delaware and Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois both raised concerns about funding last week. The snafu illustrates the tricky challenge of the group of rank-and-file senators led by Kyrsten Sinema and Portman has in navigating around committee chairs. Hachi Machi. Meanwhile, not everybody wants this thing to even happen. For example, progressive Democrats are going to want to call time on this. They say, hey, guys, you go ahead and you negotiated enough. You couldn't do it. Sorry. Too bad. So sad. Because they want to move on to their own priority. And that's passing the big reconciliation bill that they would only need all of the Democratic senators to do. That bill includes all of these soft infrastructure. So not the roads, bridges, tunnels, ports, but also social programs, climate change stuff at all. Now, that bill is currently pegged around $3 trillion, but could balloon from there if the bipartisan deal goes tits up, and then all that funding needs to be put into the reconciliation deal after all. But if you're the progressives and you're excited that the bipartisan deal isn't exactly going smoothly right now, you might want to be careful what you wish for. Because Joe Manchin, the perpetual thorn in their side, says that when it comes to his vote, the reconciliation deal without the bipartisan deal is much in the way that Frank Sinatra described love and marriage. You can't have one without the other. So if they want, they being the progressives, pronouns pal, to have Joe Manchin on their side, then they need to give him room for the bipartisan bill. Now, I know that we have said on this show that this is the week that we're going to know what happens with the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And each week, I swear we could have. And then nothing happened. And then people kind of bickered. But normally when they bicker, when they yell at each other, they start drawing partisan lines. And you can kind of know that this thing is like coming to an end because it'll disintegrate and it'll look ugly disintegrating. And up until this point, you know, everybody involved, the power players, have kind of kept their mouths shut. They haven't really had much to say about it. But over the last 48 hours, we've seen some cheap shots. We've seen Chuck Schumer come out and say, well, I really hope that these bipartisan GOP senators don't take their marching orders from Donald Trump, who says that they should walk away. And it's that kind of pressure that could bring this situation to a head. The January 6th commission has gaveled in. The initial session involved viewing footage from the attack on the Capitol, as well as testimony from the Capitol Police and Metro DC officers. Both, as they have always been, are compelling evidence that something very, very bad happened. And look, political violence is something that Americans talk a lot about, but never really have a stomach for. For every person that you've ever met that blithely likes to quote, the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants, and then takes a very deep drag from their clove cigarette, there's more than enough people that wince when you see the footage of Officer Daniel Hodges screaming for help while being crushed in a door during the January 6th riots. But a reminder here, the question with these hearings is not if January 6th was an ugly black mark on history. The question is what more we can learn about it, and if anyone can be persuaded to think anything different about January 6th via these hearings. Politically, the GOP now has to pay the price for their decision to not have any representation on this panel. You know, they could have backed the bipartisan framework, which would have guaranteed equal seats without there being one person that could veto who was the representation, like Nancy Pelosi now does. But the Republicans walked away from that, assuming that this was going to be a circus no matter what, and they'd rather the Democrats own it. Well, now they got their wish. and the Democrats will own it, and they will do anything that they want with it, and they will look to punish the Republican Party as much as they can. Now, instead of part of the larger narrative of this panel being infighting amongst it, the Republicans will have to put their talking points out separately and, quite frankly, have it covered a lot less than the hearings themselves will be covered. Now, I've compared the January 6th Commission to Benghazi before, and I know that to some of you that might come off as dismissive because of what Benghazi eventually became shorthand for. That being an overblown character assassination attempt on Hillary Clinton. But still, when you listen to the stories of what happened in Benghazi, the actual event, the tragedy that happened that led to a death, they are harrowing. And these January 6th stories are similarly harrowing. There are dead people as a result of these awful situations. But the question with the Benghazi hearings was if anybody could be swayed to believe that the State Department or the White House were reckless or malicious in their handling of that situation. And similarly, for the January 6th Commission, the question is if anybody in a position of power was reckless or malicious in their handling of that situation. We will see if the committee is able to call high-ranking Republicans, including some sitting representatives. Lauren Boebert, Louie Gohmert, Paul Gosar, the list goes on. There's also been a call to bring Donald Trump or Donald Trump's family or some of his close advisors. The understanding, at least based on what I've read of the reporting, is that none of this is likely. And even if they were speaking before the panel, they probably wouldn't say much. However, this does make for the unofficial re-debut of Donald Trump himself into the mainstream. After peppering his mailing list with updates about the various volunteer recount efforts, this puts Trump squarely back where he, and quite frankly the Democrats like him, at the center of attention. Expect to see much more mainstream media coverage of Trump's no doubt vile day by day, if not hour by hour, reaction to these proceedings. Watch for the fact that he's going to produce counter narratives, which he's already done. The latest being that Nancy Pelosi is the real person who should be blamed because she did not call for more security when she knew a rowdy crowd was coming to D.C. The fact that this connects to Donald Trump being the person that called for the rowdy crowd to show up, try not to think about it too hard. Still, Trump is back. And whether or not this January 6th commission reconvinces a single person, I can understand the strategy from the Democrats' perspective to say the more that Donald Trump is speaking for the Republican Party, the less the Republican Party can speak for itself. Or, more to the point, credibly make the conversation about Joe Biden. Thank you to everybody who has supported this show. We are trying to do some fun stuff here. Going to be out of Podcast Movement. Oh, yeah, by the way, Podcast Movement, Nashville. I'm going to be out there. It's definitely happening. And we are having a meetup. So, Nashville, Tennessee, Music City. We've got myself, the Political Orphanages, Andrew Heaton, and Congressional Dishes, Jen Briney, the political triad, who, by the way, I'm going to meet the three of, the three of us will hang out for the first time in Nashville live. Everything else has been over the internet. You will be able to hang out with us as well at Scoreboard in Nashville, August 5th at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock somewhere. Ask out early from work. Head on down. Scoreboard, that's in the Grand Ole Opry complex, so it's not downtown, a little outside of downtown. 5 p.m., August 5th, political triad meetup. This sumbitch is going to be outside. I fully reserve the right to bail after an hour if I feel like I'm about to catch the Delta, but I don't think I will. I think I'm going to hang out. I think we're going to have a great time together, and I'm very excited to actually have a convention meetup. Again, if you're going to be a podcast movement, then it is a must attend because we are right next to the convention center there. Again, that is the Political Triad Meetup, August 5th, 5 p.m. at Scoreboard in Nashville, Tennessee. If you have spent any time in the political crevices of social media, you have no doubt heard about critical race theory. We have talked about it once before on this show with our esoteric, cosmic, philosophic buddy, Kevin Ryan. But I'm excited for you guys to listen to this, and that is the voice of a father of somebody who is dealing with what I'm going to only colloquially, so you can put a handle on this conversation. Just understand that when I say critical race theory or anything else, I'm using it as a gigantic bucket that I know contains two vastly different definitions. And what this definition is the fact that there is a review of curriculum in schools of virtually all levels going on in the country. And it's a natural reaction to a societal change that has happened over the past few years. The idea that we are now more cognizant than we had been before. Woke, if you will. What is the responsibility for a school system to adjust to a changing world? How much change is too much change? And if you empower somebody to radically redefine a structure, what is the responsibility to that person to understand when they might have gone too far? I will point out that this, again, is not a funny interview. So despite the fact that Brian is a very funny comedian and writer, there's not going to be a lot of jokes here. This is a father who is very, very, very passionate about his son's education and upbringing. And so, we welcome Brian Sack. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me.
I have tried on this show to stay away from critical race theory as a conversation online because I found it to be exceptionally stupid. I don't think that anybody's talking in with any kind of good faith, which is another phrase that I hate, good and bad faith arguments. But like, it is a peak element of two things that I loathe. Number one, subjects where both sides are not even talking about the same thing, and yet they share a name for it so they can beat up on it. Yeah. And two, issues that are made larger because we are on the dark side of the moon of the political calendar. And so now the summer of the shark stories wind up becoming larger because we literally just need something to fill all of our airwaves and content holes. Yep. That being said, when we were talking about you coming on, you mentioned that this is not just a random social media issue. You have actually had boots on the ground problems with this entire controversy because of your child's school. So lay out, where does Brian Sack the father intersect with critical race theory, the cultural argument, in your personal life?
Okay. Well, I think critical race theory, it's not the right name for it because it encompasses more than just race and more is gender and sexuality and stuff, but let's just call it that, whatever.
Yeah.
So my son's school, it was a private school. And when he started as a middle schooler 3 years ago, I saw that they had hired someone to do diversity, equity, inclusion as an administrator for that. Now, okay. I knew that that was an ideological position. I knew these people are kind of activists. And so I was a little wary. And I looked up her, she went by doctor. So I looked up her dissertation and it was 319 pages of buzzwords. It was all, whiteness and African diaspora and privilege and legacy of genocide. Like it was just, it was what you would expect.
Yeah.
So I just kind of, I kind of watched to see what happened. So most of the stuff was on the surface, I thought, like hiring speakers who would come in and talk about whiteness and stuff like that, which is kind of, you bite your tongue, but you go along with it. They create affinity groups for, Black students, Hispanic students, Asian students, gay and, gender students,
which I think to that point, at least from my experience in a public school, we're not that far off. Like if you replace speakers with videos and you replace, maybe beefed up a few of the groups for, a pride amongst various communities, that doesn't seem too much of a departure from public schooling the way that I remember it. So a private school, I could kind of get it.
Yeah, you have your groups and I have mixed feelings on that. And one end, I understand, wanting to hang out. But, the other thing is my wife is from Poland. And when she first came to the States, I tried to introduce her to groups of Polish people. She's like, I grew up with Polish people. I want to hang out with Americans and other people.
Yes.
So my view of affinity groups is maybe you should just get out and hang out with everybody.
Yeah.
But whatever. So, there was that. And then there would be the occasional email she would send out to the school that was kind of a little ideological. And then last year, during the George Floyd rioting, she sent out a really aggressive, very unpleasant letter to the whole school community, basically accusing the school of being racist and that Black kids didn't feel comfortable there. And she used so many words to describe how they didn't feel comfortable there. And the school needs to, proceed with anti-Blackness and they have to, we're fixing anti-Blackness with, hiring more Black faculty, more Black students, more Black scholarships, anti-racist training for everybody. And it was just kind of, it was a very aggressive letter that made a lot of parents upset because it was kind of not true. I mean, the school is just, it's a very warm, inclusive school. I mean, there's no bullying that I've ever seen. I mean, the kids all get along. I mean, there was one kid a couple of years ago who went on a swastika rampage and they booted his ass out of the school.
Yeah.
So this was this letter did not reflect what the school was. And it was a final moment where I was like, I should just say something. But I didn't. Like most parents, you just kind of like, well, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want my kid to be, punished by either teachers or his peers. So I'm just going to bite my tongue and ride it through. So anyway, then comes June this year. School's ending. There's about a week to go. And a teacher steps forward as a whistleblower. Dana Stengel-Plough, she comes forward with a video and documentation that is up on it's a Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism.
Okay.
It's fearforall.org.
Okay.
So she comes forward as a whistleblower and basically, and resigns in this video. She offers her letter of resignation and she explains, what the school's been doing. And that's when I realized, oh my God, I thought this, the lady that hired the diversity, equity, inclusion lady, I thought she was doing all this surface stuff. And it was like, okay, you can just deal with it. But I didn't understand the level of penetration into the school, into the faculty and into the curriculum.
The reality of, and let's even remove the label of critical race theory from it. And let's just say diversity interventions or whatever, I think that's probably something that I think is more, can cut more to exactly what we are talking about, but somebody who's brought in to say, okay, the concept of schooling has been broken, and that is creating more racists that feed our society. And so we need to attack this at the root being schools. The best education money can buy literally would be at a private school. And so now this person's here. In the letter that the whistleblower puts out, the video and letter that the whistleblower puts out, what specifically is she saying the depths of the intervention is beyond just showing, you know, bringing in a couple speakers and helping sponsor a couple groups? Like how much is, you know, the inclusion of this consultant, you know, brought forward?
Well, I mean, she does mention, and she also mentioned in person, because a lot of parents have spoken with her since, that, you know, they've been dropping books from the curriculum, like To Kill a Mockingbird, because it's got a white savior narrative. That students are viewing books now, and they look at a book, and instead of reading the book, they're looking for who the oppressor is.
Yeah.
They're looking for the power dynamic in the book. They, you know, she said there was a student who was upset that a poem was written by a white guy, a white male. And it's just, you know, there's just a lot of that. There's, you know, I know that kids who have any kind of heterodox opinion or just kind of would like to speak up, don't, because they are afraid to.
Yeah.
And they're right to be afraid to, because I do think there are repercussions to anybody who challenges this orthodoxy. And so the kids learn very quickly to just kind of shut up and nod their heads. There was a class, my other son's freshman year, there was a class called Seminar. It was a new class that they removed some academic time for.
Okay.
And it's an ideology class. And it was, I remember that they gave a presentation of what the class was about to the parents. And, you know, it was a young guy, and I could just tell from his speech that he was an ideologue. And then he said, we don't teach your kids what to think, just how to think. And I absolutely did not believe him for a second. And when I went home, I pulled up his social media, because he was not clever enough to lock it down.
Yeah.
And I saw exactly what I expected to see.
Yeah.
And it was this guy who absolutely loathed the country. It was all the buzzwords again: white supremacy, legacy of genocide. He hated Thanksgiving. I mean, it was just like one thing after another. And what was really fascinating to me was, like, I watched him, because he was so open on Instagram and everything. He had gone into med school, pre-med.
Okay.
And then he kind of flunked out. It looked like he got kicked out of school for not maintaining a GPA, and he winds up with this degree in basically social justice.
Yeah.
And is now a zealot, and it's kind of almost in the same way that somebody, you know, gets radicalized by, you know, a militant group.
Yeah.
And then he comes out of this with this new passion to spread his faith. And that's exactly what he did. And that's what this class was. And you know, most of the kids just kind of, you know, bit their tongues, and it did, you know, some of the kids fell for it. Some of the kids, you know, fall for this stuff. It's an ideology. But, you know, it was so fascinating to see his social media feed and how this guy transformed into basically a religious zealot who was now proselytizing to the kids.
Proselytizing on the dime of the school.
Yeah. On my dime.
And you're not. You are paying for him to do that. Now, let me give you a response that I'm going to kind of channel through an AI that I would have that would just generate snarky tweet comments and say, right, like, oh, yeah, what's the harm? Oh, private school father, you know, like, sends his kid. What's the harm in having a few of these ideas after, you know, decades and decades and decades of non-inclusion of these ideas? What's the harm? It's the marketplace of ideas, after all.
But there is no marketplace. I mean, there's one item being sold.
Yeah.
There's no diversion from it. It's one opinion, and you either accept it or you shut up.
Yeah.
Or suffer repercussions. And it's very clear. I mean, there's, you know, when they say diversity, it's not diversity of ideas.
Yeah.
It's diversity of people who accept this particular worldview and this ideology.
So that, from a parent's perspective, is kind of the hammer. It's not necessarily that there's a conversation about, you know, anti-blackness that, right, is had. It is that there is an orthodoxy, and if you do not follow it, then there will be repercussions.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And there is no discussion. It's this is how the world is. This is what it is. This is what it is. This is what it is. No questions? Good. So you're not allowed to. And, you know, it's frustrating, because, and, you know, they people, make these claims. Oh, they, you just don't want history to be taught. And that's just absolutely not true. You know, history, every country has its dark past and it should be discussed. We should talk about slavery and internment camps during World War II and every other bad thing. This, and how can Thomas Jefferson, you know, be for freedom, but also have slaves? All things worthy of discussing.
Yeah.
But this is not what this ideology is that America is fundamentally rotten from the bottom up, and that everything caters to, you know, the white male, and everything and you know, everybody is oppressed except for the white, and it's incredibly divisive and incredibly toxic. And I've witnessed it, from the school. I've heard my kids talking. My son, was telling me how he got yelled at by a kid because there were two girls with similar names, of both of Asian descent or Southeast Asian descent. They're Indian.
Yeah.
And they had similar names, similar complexion, similar hair. And he got her name wrong, which is a completely normal, innocent thing, to call a person by the wrong name, if it's a couple of letters off. And they're, the kids are taught to take offense to that. That's a microaggression.
Yeah.
And kids, so anything innocent is now something that, the kid should feel bad. My son felt terrible because the girl got upset at him. He's like, oh, what? I just was trying to call her name. And the, one of the things that this woman was pushing for, the DEI lady, was for a system of reporting, anonymously reporting these microaggressions. So if you can imagine your young kid walking down the hallway and then a teacher comes out or a person of authority comes out and says, could you come here for a second? I need to talk to you, Justin. Mm-hmm. You hurt somebody's feelings. Oh, whose feelings did I hurt? I can't tell you. But they were very upset at what you said. What did I say? I can't tell you.
Yeah.
But I don't want you to do it again. Give me a break. I mean, give me a break. And that was one of the things that Dana, the whistleblower, came out with. She came out with this woman that held the DEI lady held a workshop for the faculty. And that's where I realized how deep it had gotten into the faculty. And it was a workshop about, okay, what do you think about your last, this year's worth of workshops? What are you going to do? And one of them was like, work to deprogram white identitarian boys. I mean, that was the actual quote. I'm going to work to deprogram white identitarian boys. In any other circumstance, that would sound racist. I'm going to take the Jew out of people.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this, give me a break. And I'm looking through these comments, and they're on the FAIR website, so anybody can see what some of these comments are. And one was, we don't need allies, we need co-conspirators. Like, what does that mean? And these are the people we are paying money to teach our kids. And this administration has willfully kind of embraced this very toxic, very divisive ideological movement. And I just don't know why.
Well, I think it's... I guess on some level, if I'm going to be an outsider, if it is a private school, then you are doing this for two reasons. You are operating as a private school for two reasons, because you are producing people, or you're producing young adults that do well. And so therefore everybody else that's coming into the community is either sending their own kids that when they have kids to this same private school, or creates a good reputation. And well, I guess that's really just it. And then I guess this is part of that, like that you don't want to be producing racist people. But I guess that would also presume that you have been producing racist people into the world for however long the school's been in existence.
This school produced Anthony Bourdain, give me a break.
Noted racist Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, exactly. And Brooke Shields, noted racist Brooke Shields. And another thing that the whistleblower alleges is that the head of school came out twice and said to the faculty, I would fire all the white faculty and replace them with people of color if I could. And that was that's a hell of an allegation.
Yeah.
And it has yet to be addressed. The school has actually not said a thing.
So, all right. Let's get into the who, what, when, where, and why of it. Like, there is the inclusion of this diversity interventionalist, and then there is a whistleblower who resigns. So she puts her name on it and then walks out the door. What has the school said? And from the parental community, is there a fight amongst the parents, or is this just total silence?
I mean, the school has said nothing. They acknowledged the evening, something came out in the New York Post. They acknowledged it at 1:45 in the morning that something came out in the New York Post. They didn't talk about it. and they've yet to say anything. And so parents are furious. So exactly what happens is what happens at every other school where this has happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of the independent schools in New York, this has happened. The parents start networking behind the scenes and getting together. And everybody's kind of wants to say something to do something, but they want to be anonymous because they're afraid of repercussions against their kids and against themselves. They don't want to be called racist. But of course, you know, this ideology already assumes you are racist. So, I mean, why even bother with that? And so they're, you know, everybody's frantically networking, texting, trying to create groups and emailing one another, trying to figure out what to do next, because they really are held captive in a way. You know, John McWhorter, you know, was saying, you should pull your kids out of the school to all the parents. And but it's like, well, it's not that easy in June.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing if this happened earlier in the year, maybe. But, you know, everybody's in between a rock and a hard place. But they're furious. They're furious that the school has not addressed it.
Yeah.
They're furious that this has been going on really unbeknownst to a lot of the parents. I mean, it's been very kind of secretive. And, you know, books being dropped from curriculums, things like that, courses being modified. It's certainly going to come to a head, I would imagine.
You know, go ahead, finish your...
No, just, you know, because people are, you know, the parents are furious. They're all talking. You know, what parents are looking for is one centralized network where parents from every school can kind of get together and be like, here's my experience. Here's what I learned. And we don't have that now. It's very fragmented.
Yeah. I would presume that you as a father just want your child to get through school in the best way possible and the happiest way possible so they can move on with their lives. Not being a father and only relying on my own, you know, memories of going through school, the one thing that I would say as an outsider is that if school now is much more ideologically rigid, and before where I you know, even in the moment I'm like, oh, my teachers are probably a little bit more liberal than my parents or my grandparents are, like, if now that is even more so, is the natural pattern for kids to then rebel or reject that? Is this maybe a course correction happening and over squeezing by an ideological force that then leads to a backlash?
Yeah, in a way, I think they're, you know, especially for you know, straight white males in the school, they feel that it is open season on them. And so, you know, they build up this kind of, defense mechanism. And,
yeah.
Because it is open season on them, really. And everybody else is in an oppressed group. You know, everybody else has an identity as an oppressed group. And these poor kids are sitting there being told that, you know, they're the oppressors by virtue of their skin color.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a phenomenally racist thing. And it's just really, it's frustrating that intelligent people running these institutions thought that this was a good idea. And it's really mind-boggling that these people are doing what they're doing. And also have, you know, the arrogance of not responding to allegations. I'm assuming probably because they're afraid that there's an audio recording of the head of school saying this. So they don't know how to defend themselves, because if he says, I never said that, and then the audio comes out, well, then that's even worse. But, it's just the fact that we can just do what we want. We can change the curriculum. We can start force feeding ideology onto the kids, and there's nothing you can do about it. Just shut up and pay.
I wonder also for the school, what is the backlash? All right. So let's say, let's lay out the school's options, right?
Right.
You can either fire the interventionalist and say this has gone too far and internal discussions have progressed further than we have led on to the parents. And so this is a situation where we're going to go in a different direction, and either we're going to hire somebody else in that same position or we're going to discontinue that position. Or you say the interventionalist is more important than this teacher. This teacher was the malcontent, and we are glad she is gone. Also, it's illegal to record us, and so we don't want to acknowledge, you know, whatever she did there.
I'd say that, you know, she was my son's freshman year English teacher, and she's great. My only grudge is that she didn't put him in honors.
Yeah.
No, she's a good teacher. She's been there a long time, and she was smart enough to get a letter of recommendation right before she resigned. that spoke about her in glowing terms. So there's actually no way the administration could turn around and say, oh yeah, she was no good. They glowed about her for multiple paragraphs at what a great teacher she was. I know my son really enjoyed her. I know other students really enjoyed her. She's been receiving letters from students saying, thank you for speaking up. She's been receiving letters from parents saying, thank you for speaking up. The funny thing is the diversity equity layer, what do you call it? Diversity interventionist, which I love. Yeah. A great term. She has moved on to the American School of London. So she is exporting her ideas. They've hired a new guy and his job is they keep adding letters. So now it's diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And I'm not sure what belonging means.
Belonging
compared to inclusion. So we'll figure that out as we go along. I don't know what the school really needs to have a come to Jesus. And be like, listen, because I mean, this stuff's in the faculty. This is now, they've hired new faculty who are activist ideologues. And that's going to affect the academics. It's going to affect the curriculum.
I guess that's probably the larger issue, because in my mind, what's shocking is I understand it in media. I understand where media leadership makes decisions based on even a small, maybe possibly not even representative sample size of social media, because people will be mad at them, right? Or press, or they'll get tortured by the press, because nobody is more sensitive to press coverage, ironically, than people who are also in the press. But like with private schools, I can't imagine an institution that has the ability to be more our way or the highway than a private school. A private school is like, all right, we got to talk to 200 families maybe at any given time. And let's get quorum with the 200 families and then go forward. Whatever the will of the families are should basically be the will of the private school. And let's say a bunch of people complain on Twitter, they're not paying tuition. Like, who cares?
Right. There are alumni now who have, who are completely flustered and upset. And they're saying, people are going to keep donating after they leave the school that told them for 4 years how crappy they were.
Yeah.
They told them for 4 years how lousy their country was. I don't think they're thinking ahead. And the thing is, we have the higher education as a model of what happens. We've seen some of these Ivy Leagues are hurting as a result of going off the deep end. And I'm surprised that these smarty pants running these private schools don't see that.
Yeah. Well, I would also imagine creating a $1 billion debt bubble for degrees that have proven to be fairly useless also hinders the ability for people or these poor collegiate institutions to fundraise in the way that they might have in the 70s and 80s.
Sure.
I'm really glad that we had this conversation, mostly because normally you are an extraordinarily funny and quick-witted guy, but what we have gotten is pure bile and anger on this.
There's been no funny.
Obviously very, very personal for you. And I do wonder, even if you are in a position where you genuinely believe that there are diversity issues that can be brought more to the fore and illustrated more to the fore, in a way that creates a better society, it doesn't seem to me, and again, I'm not of identifying of any particular oppressed group, and nor do I have kids, but like, it doesn't seem like it's working. It doesn't seem like we're creating a more, maybe a more aware world. And maybe the argument is that as we become more aware, then we create a more harmonious society. But boy, does it seem like we just have all the pain and none of the benefit.
Yeah. I mean, it honestly, it feels like years and years of progress have been squandered. Because colorblindness is considered racist. So like in this ideology. So, I mean, the idea that you can just be colorblind is not good enough. I think it's terrible. And I think it's really divided up the student bodies, and because you have kids who are, now activists and subscribe to the ideology and combat with kids who don't. I mean, it's a very, very toxic and divisive ideology. And it's a shame because I think it's really bad for the children's experience at school.
So I guess that maybe, you know, the two elements as the online conversation about critical race theory, I believe, has gotten dumber and dumber.
Oh, it's pointless. It's so stupid. It's so stupid.
The one side of it was the conversation that nobody's having is part of why I wanted to have you on, which is like parents wondering whether or not their kids are being led astray and not either, even on the base level of, I don't understand what the point of this is. Like if somebody was just trying to teach algebra by only using pictures of dogs, you would be like, okay, I don't remember learning algebra with pictures of dogs. I don't get this. Can you please explain to me how we get from A to B and how my child's going to be better at algebra than I was because of this new way to go? And then I think what you've really hit on is this other idea of, are we losing a core tenet for which you were raised on and I was raised on, even being a little younger than you, which is, this is a colorblind society. This is the point of what America is that you can leave behind burdens that are created over centuries and centuries and centuries in the old world. And here there is an egalitarian dream at the very least. And even when we've done wrong by it, the point is the larger goal that we have. And that is being subverted.
Yeah, I mean, what really upsets me is that, you know, they talk about this country like it is just the worst place, the most racist, the most oppressive place on earth. And, you know, then answer me, why do people from all over the world want to live here if we are so structurally unsound and racist and terrible? Why is the border filled with people who are dying to come here and make a better life? Why would people from Asia, Africa, south of everywhere just want to live here so badly? If we are, as these people say, such a terrible, racist, oppressive society. And they can't answer that because we're not. It's a really good country. And I traveled a lot. I've been around the world. And we're very, very, very lucky to live in the United States. You know, I've been to countries in Africa and Asia and South America. And, you know, there's very few countries I'd want to live in. And we don't appreciate what we have. And I think that's a huge problem. And to have people telling the kids that it's just a rotten place is really, you know, it's upsetting. You know, it's just such a misanthropic worldview.
As opposed to the worldview that we, I think, should all subscribe to, which is multi-ethnic, exciting, as best laid out in the Fast and the Furious franchise. We're just all, we're all together as one people racing for pinks and trying to beat Charlize Theron, who has increasingly bizarre haircuts.
What happened to melting pot? You know, what happened to everybody getting along?
You know, and that's, I remember those conversations even when I was a kid, that like, I remember watching a video that for whatever reason has stuck with me that was trying to change that idea even then. And this is in the late 80s, early 90s, that it was like, oh, we used to think of America as a melting pot. Then it was a cartoon illustration of a bunch of people from different nationalities all jumping in, and then we all came out American. And now what we want you to think of America is as a toss salad, which is, I can't imagine if they tried to put that in a video in our
Chris
modern
Rock
world.
Routine. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Post Chris Rock. I don't think that they'd be able to use this phrase.
You ruined it.
But it was a bunch of people jump. So the bowl was America and everybody jumping in was still Mexican or Russian or Polish or Chinese. Right. And I don't know. I mean, I guess the other side of it for me, and this is something that I do very much believe, that America's self-loathing complex, for which I think we have a very, very, very robust self-loathing complex, which is like kind of the definition of America is our pride matched with our ability to hate ourselves, is kind of our strength in that, like, we do, when awful things happen, it often gets resolved within a generation. Like kids see their parents doing something bad and then it changes. Like, and that is rare. It's rare in societies. And maybe it's because We are a young society. We're an even younger superpower. And money has kind of like exploded here. But I do wonder what that line is of like, okay, well, when is it ever too far? Like for us to be critical of America? And it sounds like at least for you as a parent, the answer is yes. And it's happening right now at my kid's school.
Yeah. Especially when it's only critical. I mean, when there is yeah. no discussion, it's like here, I mean, when he was in eighth grade, his reading list last year, I called it, you know, America Sucks, because it was Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you might know.
Wait, in eighth grade?
In eighth grade.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't have teachers trying to push off Howard Zinn on me until at least high school. That's
there
early.
You go. Yeah. They're starting him early. You got to get him early. And all, you know, Ibram X. Kendi.
Okay.
You know, and there was one other. And the only one I saw on this list that was just not America Sucks was John Lewis, the biography of John Lewis.
Okay.
But it was legit. Just like, I was like, how about, you know, something just that's not all gloom and doom.
Zinn's tough. I kind of feel like, look, I think there's a place for Howard Zinn.
There absolutely is. Yeah, sure. And, yeah. You know, but bring that into the curriculum, discuss. But this is the problem. You know, you bring Howard Zinn in.
It's like watching Spaceballs before Star Wars. It's like you need to have a basis. Like he's even the concept of his writing. I can't imagine if you're just reading Howard Zinn and then you're like, oh, wait, like, I don't know. It feels like you need the thing that he was countering to even get Howard Zinn. I guess. All right. Here's how we'll get you out. Where do you think it ends? Do you think that there is any kind of reckoning that comes to your child's school before your child leaves?
Well, I'm pulling my child out.
Oh, so no.
I think parents are much more empowered now, and they're seeing this has been, you know, it's kind of like a domino thing. They've seen once this happened at one school and another school and another school. And they're starting to get the sense that something's amiss. And you know, when this stuff comes into sunlight, it doesn't hold up well.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's not a lot, you know, keeping it together, except the fact that they don't let people discuss it. And, you know, they come down hard on anybody who challenges it. But as more and more people challenge it, it starts falling apart. And I think at some point they're going to say, okay, you know, we're going to stop doing this. We're going to stop doing this. You know, I think the answer is just take, you know, stop pushing ideology. It's the same. Yeah. If somebody started pushing creationism in my kid's school, I'd be furious. Or Scientology, or Catholicism, any kind of belief system that did not belong there, and that, you know, shut down any dissent. You know, that's not acceptable in a school, public, private, or anything.
Or otherwise, because it gets it interferes with the core mission of education.
Yeah, kids just need to learn. And especially the difference between your with an apostrophe and your possessive. And
if anything on the internet, a lesson that the internet has taught us, it is certainly that basic grammar written very fast on phone keyboards is very important in our modern world.
Yes.
Brian Sack, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been very illuminating.
Thank you, Justin.
The Politics, Politics, Politics podcast is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to contact Brian Sack, who was our guest today, you can go ahead and do so at px3guest.com. You want to email in, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Our Twitter is px3tweets. Our Twitch is px3live, and our podcast website, if you'd like to share it with all your friends, is px3podcast.com. Of course, you can get all of our merch, including our COVID shots equals body shots tank tops, at politicsmerch.com. You can support us with one-time direct payments to paypal.me/payjury. Our Venmo is justin-young-20, and our Cash App is px3cash. If you'd like to send anything physical to us, you can do so at P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Of course, the only way that you can get bonus content is to head on over to our premium subscription option. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. The $3 tier gets you two bonus podcasts per week covering all the news we missed during our free podcast schedule. So in addition to Wednesday and Friday podcasts, you are going to get a Monday podcast that comes out at midnight on Monday covering all the narratives of the Sunday shows that gives you the primer that you need for the week's worth of political hoo-ha. And then, of course, our Thursday show, which is the one that is produced the latest in the calendar. So if anything is going to happen and be covered, it is covered in or late in the week. It's going to be covered during the Thursday episode. Of course, the $10 tier gets you everything I just said, plus your name read at the end of the podcast like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Including Headphones Neil, Dr. G, The Other Half of Whiskey Wednesday, Idris, The Government Unfiltered Podcast, 100 Mile Runner, Berkeley Steven, Kathy Mack, Zombie Doc, D, really? Methuselah, Honeyfuckle, The Gen, Middle-Aged Mike, .com, Drunkie, Calamity, Zap, D, Laser, Lord Scale, De Quince, and Ely the Third, and Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Utah Jimmy Montana, Chad, David, Snuffies, Off Route 44, Charles, Olin and Angela, DL, Miranda Janelle, persons familiar with the matter, Robert, Casey, Paul, the most conscientious nonpartisan listeners, Brad, Frozen Summers, Jay Pink, and Andrew. You want to join their ranks? You head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. We've got a new installment of our retrospective on negative ads. And this one was a find. I had to dig deep in the record bin to find this one. We're going back to Election Night Eve, 1984. Walter Mondale's doomed campaign runs a 5-minute ad, and we're only going to focus on the first minute. It involves Crosby, Stills, Young, and Nash. It involves a bunch of children and a bone crushing reminder that we are all going to die and the government doesn't care. Oh, yeah, it's a good one. Till then, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss. Oh, three.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.